Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll explore a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, who in January of 2005 became the first member of Congress to demand a withdrawal from Iraq. Today, almost 2 years later, Congresswoman Woolsey has called upon the President, the Congress, and her own party to heed the call from the American people for a military withdrawal from Iraq rather than an increase of troops in what is being suggested as a military surge. And then we'll also speak with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005, and the first insider to describe the dysfunctional nature of the Bush regime and the extent to which Vice President Cheney runs the country in what Lawrence Wilkerson described as a cabal, or he's the head of a cabal that runs the country, if you will. And then we'll speak with Jim Zogby, who is the president of the Arab American Institute. He commissioned a poll on the Arab world's attitudes towards the United States, a very startling, disturbing poll that reveals the extent to which antipathy for the United States has increased alarmingly during the Bush administration. I'm now speaking with Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, who was in January 2005 became the first member of Congress to demand a withdrawal from Iraq. And today, almost 2 years later, she's called upon the President, the Congress, and her own party to heed the call from the American public for a military withdrawal from Iraq rather than an increase in troops in what is now being described and suggested as a military surge. So, Congresswoman Woolsey, you've called for courage and leadership in Iraq, and it seems to me that that's really the nub of the issue, because we're sort of stuck in this kind of Groundhog Day situation, which the senator from Oregon, a conservative Republican, just the other day described as insane or absurd and even perhaps criminal, that the soldiers go out every day on the same route and they get blown up by the same bombs. And it seems to me that at the heart of what we have here is a leadership that simply is paralyzed, and they won't act because their reputations are at stake.
Ian, I agree with you. Thank you for having me on your program, by the way. Following the election, which it seems like there's some sense that that was the first day of the occupation in Iraq, like it hadn't been going on for 3 years, but the very idea that the same White House leadership that got us into this mess and led it so horribly would be given any more time, that idea is preposterous to me. And I really know that the world's looking for U.S. leadership, and that ending military occupation is going to take courage, but it must be done.
But is this therefore the time to take off the gloves and call our leaders cowards, which is what they appear to be? If they can't take responsibility for their own mistakes and blunders, and if this requires more blood, lost lives and limbs of our boys and girls, because these people simply don't have the guts to admit that they were wrong and that there's no way out and it's time to pull the plug.
Well, for me, this issue of occupation in Iraq in the past and continues for me to be the moral issue of our time. And I'll continue to press a plan to bring our troops home. And you know what? I'm confident that my leadership is moving in that direction.
You're talking about Nancy Pelosi and the caucus?
Yes.
And you're the the vice chair or the deputy of the Progressive Caucus?
I am the co-chair with Barbara Lee of the Progressive Caucus. And we have Maxine Waters and Barbara Lee and Lynn Woolsey as the chairs of the Out of Iraq Caucus.
And given that Gordon Smith, the conservative senator from Oregon, made that rather low-key but very passionate speech the other day in the Senate, suggesting that, in fact, our leaders may be criminal in the way that they've abused and lost the lives of the soldiers for no apparent strategic or even tactical purpose. Does this mean that there is a possibility of a Republican defection in the House and the Senate from the president's policies?
Well, we can hope so. I believe it will occur, but my position right now is that we don't act like we're starting all over. I mean, look what's happening. I mean, the president has our troops in an absolutely no-win situation. And these troops are so brave. They're so courageous. They need the same level of leadership from the civilian leadership that they're expressing in Iraq themselves. So I hope in a bipartisan way we'll be willing to step up to what is the Congress's responsibility. And if the president refuses to follow our lead, then we have to strip him of the funding from the Iraq budget.
And that, I imagine, is for the leadership, that probably is a little politically uncomfortable, isn't it? Won't they be charged by the White House with abandoning our boys and girls in harm's way?
Yes, but hasn't the White House been villainizing any of us that have known from the very beginning that we shouldn't be there, that the troops didn't have the equipment and the training they needed, that the situation is getting worse every day that we're there, and my goodness, look what's happening to our veterans. They're going to come home without the veterans' support that they need and deserve. There is so much going wrong that to follow anything and worry about what they say in the White House, it just doesn't make sense to me.
So, Congresswoman Woolsey, do you think that the White House's strategy, if strategy is not too kind a word, do you think that it's that what the president's trying to do is kick the can down the road to the next guy, that basically he doesn't want to go down in history as the guy who cut and run from Iraq, and that he will just try and do whatever it takes to keep this agony going so that he can look good in the history books?
Well, he won't look good, and the very idea that the same person that refuses one of the proposals I supported in the Baker-Hamilton report to engage internationally with other countries around the region, that he refuses to do this, the idea that we'd give him 2 years to leave our troops in harm's way, to send more troops there, which, you know, we know actually threatens our own country, because then we don't have military on the ground. We're here in our own country. So we are just depleting our military. It's wrong all the way around, and that we would give him 2 years to wiggle his way out of that responsibility is irresponsible of any member of Congress.
There's been some recent articles, Congresswoman Woolsey, Paul Krugman in the New York Times and Walter Pincus in the Post, pointing out of the 126 members of the Democratic House that voted against the war resolution in October of 2002, there was virtually no reporting in the press about what these people did who opposed the war, and you were one of them. The point being that much of what was said on the floor in that debate in terms of opposition to the war resolution was quite prescient and accurate. So how come people like you aren't being praised?
That's a good question, isn't it? Because I don't think people see actual successes from our actions, and you know, the public, they want us out of Iraq. They're confused about how and when. That's not their job. It's our job to define the parameters of leaving, and then they can trust that we know what we're doing. And we need to force the president. All along, I've actually been saying it's the commander-in-chief's job to put that plan together. Well, I've given up on him. And, I mean, but it is his job.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm putting together my own legislation. And it really says, repeal the authorization for use of military force in the Iraq resolution of 2002. And then go from there to troops out and support for the Iraqis by the middle of the year, 2007.
Of course, in the New York Times on Sunday, there's an article suggesting that the vice president who, and we'll be having following you, Colin Powell's former chief of staff, Colonel Wilkerson, who was the first to describe the country being run by a cabal surrounding Vice President Cheney. There is a sense that you get from the Baker Commission and the extent to which the White House has tried to distance themselves from it, that there's a real behind-the-scenes battle going on here between Jim Baker and the president's father's men versus Dick Cheney, who in many ways seems to be the real power in the White House. So do you have a sense that that's where the battle lines are?
I have a sense that there's battle lines all over, and I think your next interview will be very, very informative to the public
right. And
your listeners. There are so many battle lines. I think the worst battle line of all is I don't believe that our president, the commander-in-chief, actually has his intelligence wrapped around what's going on over there. Instead, it's just being stubborn. And
do you think he's in denial? Do you think he's in denial, Congresswoman?
Well, if he cares to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Our whole country told him and told the leadership of the Congress that they want on Election Day that it is time to change the direction of what's happening in Iraq. And the very idea that within a few short weeks, the president saying he's going to stay the course, in fact, he's going to worsen it, I don't know what he thinks.
Well, just in closing, Congressman, tell me what you're going to do when you get back and when the Democrats take over the House in January. I take it that Nancy Pelosi wants to hit the ground running. Surely this is the key issue. The fact that the majority of the American people are backing you and your colleagues, it seems like, you know, you're calling for courage and leadership. I don't see any courage or leadership from the White House, so it's going to have to come from you guys.
It certainly is. We're going to have to step up to our responsibility as members of Congress and take some very courageous steps. And I myself, because of I'm believing this is the moral issue of our times, I'm going to continue to press. I've spoken over 175 times on the House floor. I've brought the debate once to the floor in the form of an amendment, and it didn't, you know, it was a bipartisan, it wasn't a win, but it was a bipartisan vote. It was very meaningful. And I'm going to continue in that direction. I will be introducing my own legislation on my plan to bring the troops home.
And
believe me, it won't be in 2008.
No, but I'm just trying to get a sense of what to expect next January in terms of will there be a cohesive plan or will there be a lot of piecemeal amendments? I mean, again, leadership we're talking about.
Well, I can't speak for leadership. I know the first 100 hours of legislative business addresses issues that the Democrats are totally together on, and I'm with them on all of those issues. My question is, why is Iraq not one of those issues?
Well, you've got the majority of the American people behind you, so I wish you all the best.
The majority of my district behind me. I am so very fortunate. The people here in the 6th Congressional District of California have been against this from the beginning and cannot believe that we're talking about staying longer with more troops.
I thank you very much, Congressman Lynn Woolsey, for joining us today.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, who in January 2005 became the first member of Congress to demand a withdrawal from Iraq. And today, almost 2 years later, she's called upon the President of the Congress and her own party to heed the call from the American public for a military withdrawal from Iraq rather than an increase in troops and what is now being suggested as a military surge. I'm now speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the Chief of Staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. Today is the Pamela Harriman Visiting Professor of Government at the College of William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. And Colonel Wilkinson, you were the first to describe a cabal in the White House. Obviously, the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal has been somewhat altered, given the departure of Mr. Rumsfeld, who was sent off with the military honors the other day from the Pentagon. But there is an article in today's New York Times suggesting that the vice president is pretty much in the driver's seat in terms of choosing what to do vis-a-vis the Baker Hamilton report, and there's even a suggestion that they may back the Shiites because they're the majority and they've got the oil. But the long and the short of it is, you don't have any confidence that there's any real leadership going on here.
I certainly don't. I had an op-ed in the New York Daily News on the 8th of December to that effect. In that op-ed, I essentially said that if everything were perfect, if the Iraq Support Group and other bodies of advisors that are giving the president their views at this time were all composed of angels and their recommendations were perfect, this administration would have neither the skill, the diplomatic capabilities, or the leadership to carry out what the recommendations gave them. I still believe that. I believe that Vice President Cheney has a lock hold on this administration, that he has adamant views about policy, and that those views won't change. And I despair of this administration making any meaningful strategic change. They'll make some tactical changes, perhaps on the margin, but any meaningful strategic change, I believe, is beyond their predilection, their political will, and their capability to carry out.
And you mentioned in your article that Cheney is a formidable force, and that now, of course, because of the ineptitude of this administration in Iraq, we don't have any strategic leverage, and the Iranians have all the strategic leverage. And it's worth noting that you pointed out that on April the 10th of 2003, when the statue of Saddam toppled, the Iranian regime quietly contacted the White House through back channels and said, we want to talk about everything and put everything on the table, and our authority to speak comes from the highest authority, meaning the Ali Khamenei, the religious leader, and the Iranian regime thought that they'd be next. And so that was the moment of maximum leverage. And what happened?
Well, it was the moment of maximum leverage. I suspect that in both Damascus and Tehran, they were shivering in their boots, thinking that shock and awe was coming to them next. And so that I think, was a major motivation for the opening. But what happened to that was Vice President Cheney shut it down. We do not talk to evil. We do not talk to our enemies. That's a mantra with Vice President Cheney, and apparently the president is of the same mind. After all, he's the decider. But we will not talk to anyone. It's absurd, for example, that right now we're not talking to Damascus. We have an embassy there. We have an ambassador there. We're not talking to them in any meaningful way. We're not even really talking to them about tactics that they could be helping us with. Certainly not talking to them about the regional situation in general. Or at least if we are, I certainly can't perceive it. And that's absurd, because Syria has no strategic reason to be cheek and jowl with the Persians, with Iran. The reason Syria is forced into being cheek and jowl with Iran right now is because of our ineptitude. We've given her no other choice. And the idea is preposterous that if we negotiated with Damascus, we'd have to trade Lebanon. No one trades Lebanon. Hassan Nasrallah and Hezbollah and his Christian allies and Prime Minister Sanoria are in a standoff right now, but the Lebanese are the ones who are going to decide the fate of Lebanon, not France, not America, not Syria, not Iran. And we need to understand that, realize that, and aid and abet that process, not hinder it. But the idea is preposterous that Dr. Rice was offering that, you know, we're not going to trade Lebanon for Iraq. We wouldn't have to do that with skillful diplomacy, but I return to my original point. This administration has no capacity for skillful diplomacy.
No capacity, no interest. So they don't have the talent, but they don't have the mindset, right?
They don't. know.
So here we have the King of Jordan just recently saying that in 2007 there'll be three civil wars in the region, the continuing civil war in Iraq, which is destined to get worse, perhaps a civil war in Lebanon, and a civil war between the Palestinian. Now we've, you know, the factions are starting to fight.
Right.
And it's essentially, we have spent so much time arguing the semantics of whether or not there's a civil war. Maybe now what we should be talking about is whether or not there's going to be a regional war.
And that's a very good point. David Rothkopf had a piece you may have seen in the Outlook section of the Washington Post here not too long ago, and the title was something like, "If we leave, we'll be back." And he's absolutely right. This is not Vietnam. Vietnam was not a strategic matter for the United States. It became a strategic matter, in a sense, only because of the diminishment of our reputation and our prestige when we left so ignominiously. But it, in and of itself, it was not strategic. The Middle East is as strategic as it can be. We're talking about, at the top end of that strategic geopolitical situation, 1.3 billion Muslims, all of whom we don't want lined up against us. And at the bottom end, we're talking about the Persians and the Iranians, having control over the Strait of Hormuz, the Persian Gulf, potentially putting pressure on the Saudis and others in the region, and are having essentially no power to influence that because we're so overcommitted in Iraq. We're also looking at the potential, as you said, for a regional-wide war. And, you know, I go back to the 30s, and I don't derive the same parallels or analogies from the 30s that Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney and those boys do. What I derive is this might be the beginning of a huge crisis. And as is the custom with our democracy, we don't seem to do things right until the crisis is on top of us and we're buried in it. Pearl Harbor, for example. Even though we have presidents who try to figure out how to do things beforehand, as Franklin Roosevelt was trying to do, we have a president now who doesn't even know where he is. Mm-hmm. In this battle, we should be prepared to do what's necessary, and we aren't. We haven't mobilized. We haven't raised taxes. We haven't looked at any of the considerations that we're going to have to look at if we really botch this so badly that what you just talked about becomes a reality. That is to say, we have a region-wide war, and we're the only people in the world who can do anything about it.
But it does seem, though, given our boys and girls losing lives and limbs in the absence of a strategy, and once you make a strategic blunder, as many have suggested is the case in Iraq, then there's no tactical magic that can overcome a strategic blunder. Isn't it kind of like original sin?
It is, and that's why I despair when I have to think about it. Very difficult for me to be optimistic about this anymore.
Well, then, what we are faced with is perhaps what Senator Gordon Smith was talking about the other day on the floor of the Senate, that he said that our troops doing the same thing every day, taking the same routes and being blown up, if we'd have by the same bombs, if we do this surge, it will just mean more of the same, will it not? And doesn't it, at the end of the day, come down to the fact that our leaders are paralyzed and won't act because their reputations are at stake?
I think that's a part of it, and this surge business is rather ridiculous anyway. The only way we could surge, because the Army and the Marine Corps are at a breaking point right now, is by moving troops inside Iraq and a few troops from outside Iraq, and all we're going to be doing is getting troops from outside Iraq there faster than they were planned to get there, and from inside Iraq, taking them away from other areas that will then become hot because they've left them. So it's I would guess that maybe 90 to 120 days is all we could even sustain that increase. So if we don't have victory at the end of that time period, what do we do then? Wrap it up and come home? This is not a recipe for success, talking about surging troops, because we simply don't have the troops to surge.
So is it possible that the president simply wants to kick the can down the road and hand this mess off to the next guy or girl, given that he doesn't apparently want to be the guy that cuts and runs? I mean, is it possible to continue the agony?
I do think this administration made a fundamental decision right before the November 7th elections And I think that decision was much of what you just said. Let's kick most of these challenges about which we can't do anything down the road and let the next woman or man who walks into the Oval Office handle them. But I think that Iraq has the potential of all the challenges the administration is confronting to not allow them to do that. I think it may haunt them right to the door of their departure from the White House. I think they're going to have to do something. And again, though, I come back to my original point. I despair of what they might do because they haven't shown me anything to this point.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Chief of Staff to the Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. Today he is the Pamela Harriman Visiting Professor of Government at the College of William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. And it does seem almost obscene to me, Colonel Wilkerson, that again, it's the boys and girls in harm's way that are getting the short end of this deal. And in a way, you can argue that America's not at war, but the United States Army and the Marines are at war.
It is obscene. In fact, I applaud the use of that word. It is obscene. We have less than 1% of America bleeding and dying for the other 99%+. And that's obscene. Let's face it. John Kerry notwithstanding, these are men and women who in many cases are in the armed forces because of socioeconomic conditions. Not to say they aren't patriotic, not to say they aren't brave to a fare thee well, they are. But to say that they had other choices is nonsense. In our society, what our volunteer force recruits from is the socioeconomic conditions, the people from those conditions, by and large, who have very few other choices. And you combine all these things about our democracy and our republic, and you start worrying about the very foundation of our values and our beliefs.
And what do you think's going on in Washington in terms of the battle lines, given that I've never seen anything like what happened a week or so ago with the release of the Baker-Hamilton report? It was as though the president was being graded by his father's advisors and given a failing grade. And you get the impression that the battle lines behind the scenes here are essentially Jim Baker, who's acting at the behest of the father to rescue the son's presidency and perhaps even the father's own legacy, on the one hand, and the obdurate kind of eminence gris, who apparently has inordinate power in this administration, Dick Cheney on the other. So I don't see those two as being mutually exclusive. It seems to me that it has to go one way or the other, right?
I think what you're seeing, in part at least, if not large part, is very, very great frustration on the part of what I would call sane people in the Republican Party. I mean, the 7 November election was just the latest manifestation of their frustration. Some good Republicans were defeated simply because they were associated with this administration and the Iraq policy in particular. And they have been trying for 2 years behind the scenes, from Brent Scowcroft to Jim Baker, you name it, to influence this administration, to indirectly give it advice and so forth, and they've failed. They've failed miserably. And I think this is the latest manifestation of their frustration because they actually had to go public, and that's really what the ISG is a public statement on the failed policy of this administration on the issue that is going to be their legacy, Iraq.
And, of course, the new nominee, or now the Secretary of Defense, who starts on Monday, in his hearing, he made it clear that we're not winning in Iraq. And to some extent, that was a repudiation of the president, who keeps saying we're making progress.
It was. And how ironic that he should give it to the one committee that has failed in its oversight responsibilities so miserably. The Senate Armed Services Committee. It is appalling to me that the separate and equal branch of government called the Congress, and in particular that committee, has not had people before it, before Bob Gates, telling it the truth about Iraq. That's one of the greatest failures of this administration, too, is the Congress's failure to live up to its responsibility to exercise oversight. I hope and pray that the Democrats will do a much better job of it. It is a day late and a dollar short, literally. Well, it's a trillion and almost $2 trillion short. But I do hope that they start to exercise their oversight responsibilities.
But if the president is disengaged, which is a polite way to describe what many people see as a man in denial, what do you think can reach him? Would people like Gordon Smith making statements like that, and he was apparently congratulated by a number of conservative Republican senators who said that they agreed with him. Is it possible that there'll be a Republican defection? I mean, in other words, what do you think Colonel Wilkinson is going to get this president's attention and give him the courage to face up to his responsibilities?
I'm not sure anything can. And again, I say that's why one reason why I despair. I do think the Congress, probably exercising its power over the purse over the next 2 years, if it sees absolutely no change, or if it sees change that's just on the margins and doesn't really affect the substantive situation, I think they'll start to exercise the power of the person. Whether they do that peripherally in the beginning, for example, as they did in Vietnam, restricting any actions outside certain geographic areas and so forth, or whether they do that very straightforwardly and substantively, of course, will be up to them. But they can tie this president's hands with the purse. They're very reluctant to, of course, because we've got boys and girls in harm's way. But
which is what the White House will, of course, argue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that argument's going to fall on deaf ears, though, if the Congress perceives that they're just going to be more dead and wounded boys and girls if they don't do something.
So in the broader strategic landscape, as you point out in your article, Colonel Wilkinson, that we, through sheer incompetence, we have empowered Iran, and we can see that there is a hegemonic ambition there on the part of Ahmadinejad, and it's got the Saudis alarmed, it's got the Jordanians alarmed, and the fact that that the Shiites in Iraq, each faction seems to have some Iranian connection, and Sada is connected to the Revolutionary Guards, and there's obviously a possibility that the Ahmadi army will, in fact, if it's not already, is a mirror of Hezbollah. So the Shia are ethnically cleansing Baghdad as we speak of the Sunni. The Sunni are now back in Al Anbar, which is an empty sand lot, so they have nothing, they have no oil, and a million refugees are in Jordan, straining that country. That's where the insurgency is being operated out of, and now you hear from the Saudis that they're not going to allow their Sunni brethren to be overrun. So these are all, to me, indications that we already have a surrogate war.
I think you're probably right. I'm also very concerned about the next level of violence in Iraq being Shiite on Shiite. We have the Maliki Dawah Party, we have the Al-Hakim Skiri, and we have, as you said, al-Sadr's Badr Corps and the militia that's around him. I'm told we already have this kind of violence in the south. It could spread, and we have the Shia realizing that they're going to be the ultimate winners, and then trying to decide amongst themselves who's going to sit at the top of that ultimate mountain. And so we have not just criminals and terrorists and Sunni insurgents, but we have Shia fighting Shia. That could get very interesting and make the civil war even more intense than it already is. But back to your original point about Iran, yes, we've put them in a position, for example, where I believe Israel is in as precarious a strategic position as she's been in a long time. That certainly was not the intent of people like Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney and others, but I believe through their ineptitude we have endangered Israel. Israel is confronting now an Iran that most surely will have a nuclear weapon in the not-too-distant future, and very little she can do about it. And very little that her godfather, her sugar daddy, the United States, can do about it, because of the position that we've put the region in and the strategic leverage that we've afforded to Iran. So if anybody was going about all of this in order to ensure the security of Israel, they failed miserably.
Well, you have to add to that dismal landscape, Colonel Wilkinson, the fact that Al-Anbar province, the western province, which is about 200 miles from Israel, is now roiling. And according to the recent Marine Corps intelligence report, it already belongs to Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
So in effect, we've already moved Al-Qaeda 1,000 miles closer to Europe and within 200 miles of Israel.
Yeah, I'm not discounting Al-Qaeda, but I'm not as worried about Al-Qaeda because I believe the Iraqis will take care, the Sunnis in particular, will take care of Al-Qaeda as soon as there is some sort of stability in Iraq. They have no love for Al-Qaeda. I mean, you get rid of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, I think, by bringing some sort of security and stability to Iraq so that some sort of government within Iraq can take care of the problems within its own borders. I think that'll happen once some sort of stability and security is secured in Iraq.
But what explains King Abdullah of Jordan's nervousness? Isn't it the fact that his country's being overwhelmed by refugees? It's already 60% Palestinian.
I understand there's 750,000 Iraqis in Syria and maybe 700,000 in Jordan. Yes, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about almost a million extra people flowing into both countries.
So,
and those, by the way, those are not anything but your most Western-oriented, your most secular, your highest educated, generally, because they're the people who are leaving. Mm-hmm. And they're the people you need to stay if you want to build a viable society in Iraq.
But that seems to be the unintended consequence of this reckless utopianism of the neoconservatives. That is, that the secular forces are being undermined by our policies, the religious forces are being empowered.
You put your finger right on it. We're disempowering the moderates, and we're empowering the radicals.
But that doesn't speak well for Israel's future. Their treaty with Egypt is solid. If the Muslim Brotherhood, in fact, in the last election, but for Mubarak's voter suppression, the Muslim Brotherhood would have probably even won. So, and then King Abdullah is also nervous of his frail country falling apart. So I would think that obviously there is something going on here behind the scenes in terms of the Saudis saying, to the United States and to Israel, we want a deal, we want a Palestinian Israeli settlement, so that, because we can't be seen dealing with you people as long as you're humiliating the Palestinians, and that is the price for us to cooperate with you against Iran.
I think that's part of it, and I fault this administration in a major way for not moving aggressively to reassert our honest broker credentials with regard to the Palestinian-Israeli situation, and on a larger scene with regard to the Israeli-Arab situation. We've just been totally remiss in that regard. It is a part of the problem. It's not a panacea. It's not something that will fix everything tomorrow morning, but it is something that we must demonstrate to the Arabs and the Palestinians that we are concerned about and that we are moving out to try and fix. And we're simply not doing that. We've just thrown up our hands, apparently, and said, oh, that's too tough.
But that's where I wonder about the forces aligned in this kind of battle that's going on in Washington for the mind, if you will, of the president, between Baker and the father's people, and Cheney, who's, you know, many sort of describe as a kind of Darth Vader figure. That you, in this landscape, what has Baker got to back him up? Because calling for Israel to get off the dime has already led to not just the neoconservatives trashing the Baker-Hamilton Commission, but a lot of Congress people and the Israeli government have rejected that linkage out of hand.
Well, they have, and I think that's just your normal gut reaction of many people in this country who simply don't want to have a really solid, critical look or review of U.S. policy. And it's something that you can get beyond, though, if you've got the leadership and you've got the courage to do it. And I think we have to get beyond it. Let's face it, at Camp David 2 and later at Taba, Clinton and Barack came as close, and Arafat, came as close to a final settlement as anybody's going to get and not get there. I mean, one of my friends, Palestinian friends, said, you know, a hair's breadth is how far apart they were. Of course, the press and everything didn't show that, but research does demonstrate that, and I think Dennis Ross and Aaron David Miller and others who were involved in it would verify that. We came very close. We now have the ingredients of a final solution. It just takes leadership and people who are concerned with peace to sit down and talk about that. But even if we didn't achieve it in the year or 2 years that's left of this administration, 3 years or 4 years in the first or the next administration, we still would be demonstrating to our Arab friends that we are concerned with that situation and that we are doing something about it. What have we demonstrated in that regard except Bush declaring that there will be a Palestinian state? And everyone now thinks that declaration was as hollow as most else of this administration's declaration.
And brought about because of Saudi pressure.
Exactly.
So just in closing, Colonel Wilkinson, if the Baker-Hamilton report is in fact, as some describe, adult supervision from the father's people to try and rescue the son, in effect, from himself, it does seem that he's throwing away the lifeline. And one of the paradoxes here is that you would think that, I understand that the Baker's people would like a bigger role for Condoleezza Rice and get her to show her stuff, if you will. Is there any way, I know you can't fire a vice president because he's elected, but you'd think that the Republican Party people are looking at the fact that this war could basically turn them into a minority party for decades, and they haven't got a chance of getting back the executive branch unless they can come up with a strong ticket like perhaps a McCain-Rice ticket. So I'm talking about giving her promotion and some on-the-job training.
Well, you can't fire a vice president, but you can isolate him. Cheney would be very, very difficult to isolate, but you could if you were serious about it. My difficulty is I don't believe the president is serious. With regard to Dr. Rice, I think she should be empowered. Big question mark over my head right now is Dr. Rice's recent statements about not being able to conduct meaningful diplomacy with Syria, certainly not being able to conduct it with Iran and so forth. Is that coming from her beliefs, or is that coming from pressure by Cheney on her? I don't know, but I do think that's a big question. If it's coming from her beliefs, then she's not nearly the diplomat that I thought she might be, and so it wouldn't make any difference if she were unleashed. If it's coming from Cheney's vice grip on her, then it's a different situation, and the president could move to isolate the vice president and let Condi go, and therefore, as you said, help the prospects of the party in the future, and more importantly for me, help the prospects of diplomacy in the Middle East.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Colonel Lawrence Wilkinson. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Colonel Lawrence Wilkinson, who was the Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell from August 2002 to January of 2005. And now he is the Pamela Harriman Visiting Professor of Government at the College of William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. And I'm now speaking with Jim Zogby, who is the president of the Arab American Institute, and he commissioned a poll on the Arab world's attitudes towards America, and this poll has come up with some startling revelations of the extent to which antipathy for the United States has increased alarmingly in the Bush administration. So let's use some adjectives here, Jim Zogby. It went from they don't like us, they're disgusted with us, they're angry with us, they're enraged at us. Where are we? Where are we? Is there any adjective that can go beyond rage?
I think the disturbing part was that we've been doing this every year since 2002. After Gallup did their poll right after 9/11, trying to answer the question, why do they hate us? Gallup found that they didn't like us, which we thought was quite understandable given a lot of things that were going on in early 2002. But we thought that that was not the right way to ask the question, what do you think about America? I said at the time it was sort of like asking a woman who just threw her husband out for being a serial cheater, what do you think of men? instead, ask her what she thinks about fathers or sons or uncles or cousins, and and then maybe husbands and get the negative, and maybe the negative toward husband would draw everything down. Well, we did the same thing with America. We asked a series of questions about the way America manifests itself, and what we found was that they liked the American people, they liked American products, they liked American culture, they liked American freedom and democracy, they liked American science and technology, etc. They didn't like American policy. And American policy dragged down the overall number when you asked, what do you think of America? I wrote an article at the time that said, it's the policy, stupid. What we have to say right now is that it's all of the above. They're not liking our people anymore. They're not liking our culture. They're not liking our product. That is the disturbing thing in this poll, is the overall numbers have gone down, yes, but numbers for all of the other ways America manifests itself have also gone down, and it means that there's a hardening of negatives where they're not liking a whole lot about us right now, and I think that's quite disturbing.
Well, you found out that 90% of the people in Jordan have an unfavorable opinion of the United States, 83% in Egypt, 82% in Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's all across the region, right, from Saudi Arabia to Morocco.
Well, and you know what? If you poll in Europe and you poll in the Americas, you get somewhat the same. I mean, numbers are down everywhere. This administration has done real damage to America's standing in the world, but in the Middle East in particular, the damage has been extraordinary, and I think salvaging that is not going to be easy. But frankly, if we don't begin to work at it, it really can get worse. And I think that when I get, you know, this article of mine's been appearing all over the place recently, and I've been getting lots of responses from people: "What do we care? So what? We don't like them either." Well, the problem here is that we have, you know, 150,000 of our young men and women in the middle of their region. We have enormous interests in that region. We have tens of thousands of American business people, 30,000 in Saudi Arabia alone. And the amount of American investment in that region is huge. And our interest in promoting peace and stability has been one that has consumed every administration now for some almost 40 years. So in answer to the question, does it matter? It really does matter. And the risks of it not being corrected can be enormous. But I don't find this administration wanting to get out of a hole, or maybe even knowing that we're in a hole to begin with.
Well, our previous guest, Colonel Wilkinson, who was chief of staff to Colin Powell through the first 6 years of this administration, he was the first to coined the term the cabal running this country, the Cheney cabal. He was saying that, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but somewhat, he was saying that basically, you know, it's no longer an issue of whether there's a civil war in Iraq. It's the real issue is whether there's going to be a regional war, and the consequence of a regional war would be very likely a cutoff in the oil. So this is the most strategic place that, you know.
And it's bigger than oil. I mean, let's be clear about it. There are human consequences to all of this, too. And before this war, I remember arguing quite vigorously with the State Department and the White House and even my own party, I'm a Democrat, that you don't go into a war in a country whose culture and history you don't understand. You don't go into a war unless you know what the consequences are. And I will not, for one, forgive Colin Powell for not standing up and affirming the Powell Doctrine. I learned from him. You don't go into a war unless you know how you're getting out of that war. You don't go into a war unless you understand the consequences and the terms of commitment and whether or not you're willing to make the commitment to win that war. And we went into Iraq knowing and answering none of the above. And so, frankly, these were not unpredictable issues. But the most dangerous one is yes, the terrible loss of life in Iraq, yes, terrible consequences in Iraq, but we knew from the get-go, those of us who know that region, that the dangers of drawing Iran and Turkey and Saudi Arabia, et cetera, into a broader regional conflict are enormous, and the consequences in the Gulf and beyond are huge. You know, I said early on that the most vulnerable community that would pay the dearest price that nobody was paying attention to were the Christians in Iraq. And today, that country has been near depopulated of Christians. It's an ancient community that goes back to almost the time of Christ. They've paid a horrible price. And this bizarre president who claims to be Christian has stood by and let this Christian community that was almost a million suffer. I think that it has gotten so bad, one needs to ask the question quite seriously, wasn't it better when Saddam was alive? I mean, that's how bad it's gotten.
Mm. Well, we've essentially assassinated the country. We have basically, to paraphrase Ambassador Chaz Freeman, it's drive-by democracy. But to many,
it an infantile fantasy.
Yeah, but to many people in the Arab world, I understand, in their efforts to try and understand. Because in the Arab world, and particularly in the Persian world, there's a lot of conspiratorial thinking, and they're always looking for the reason behind the obvious. So many people in that region apparently are saying, well, the Americans must have planned to screw up this badly, because what else explains it, right?
Yeah, and part of it is due to the fact that, there is such a sense of respect for us. We can't be that stupid, they assume. We cannot be that unaware of the consequences of what we do. So when the consequences go awry, their assumption is we had to have known this all along. Why else would we have done it? And convincing people in the region that we really can be very stupid is sometimes a tough sell. But we're victims in this instance of the fact that people think we're smarter than we are. One of the reasons why the negative numbers are as high as they are, incidentally, is that they cannot believe that we are just plain insensitive or that we're just plain stupid. They know what our values are. They know what we project in terms of our commitments. But when we don't apply our values or commitments to them, they feel betrayed, jilted, angered, and all the rest.
So what do you think's happening here in terms of, the Baker-Hamilton Commission made it pretty clear that they wanted the Israeli-Palestinian issue to return to the forefront, and I understand from the concluded conversation with Colonel Wilkerson that the Saudis have basically contacted both the American government and the Israeli government and saying, look, we want to work with you guys to head off Iran's hegemonic push in the region, but we can't work with you as long as you're humiliating the Palestinians. So you got to make this deal and do it right away. As you know, Jim Zogby, things are getting out of hand in the territories.
Well, they've been out of hand, and the problem is that this also was not unexpected. The fact is that when oppression occurs over a long period of time, violence can be directed at the oppressor. But if the violence of the oppressor continues and despair sets in, what then happens is that the violence turns inward. And we've seen that all over the world. Saw it in South Africa for a long time.
You mean between the Zulu and the Hausa?
Yeah, and saw it here in African-American communities. After the uprisings of the 60s and the sense that civil rights and the civil rights movement might have brought some hope, what happened then was that the violence then turned inward, and you had this tremendous increase in violence and death inside America's ghettos. And the other form of inward turning violence is drug addiction, etc. People literally committing suicide, and that is happening in Gaza and the West Bank. And the hope of the 90s has given way to total despair. And this is what you get: young men willing to kill themselves and thinking that there's honor in it. People now striking out against each other, fighting over stakes that don't exist, because they simply don't know where else to go with the pent-up rage that they feel over the despair that has affected their lives. Now, given that, yes, there is a sense in the Arab world that there's a danger looming from Iran and something needs to be done, but they cannot begin to focus on it because these other issues are there: in imploding Iraq, a devastated Palestine, this threat and tension over Lebanon. And in the polling that we get, it's interesting. Iran actually now polls well. Iran has become the Farrakhan of the Arab world, which is to say, if you're angry at America, you then end up taking the side of the group that stands up against America. And so there's this sense that Iran is to be defended on the Arab street. But the Arab regimes, of course, the governments feel quite concerned about this fact.
Well, just in closing,
they know what the ambitions of that government in Iran are, and they're not good ambitions.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, Jim Zogby, President Carter has written a book that's trying to be helpful. Do you believe, or do you think, that there is a possibility that there we'll have a proper debate, a real debate about Israel-Palestine,
happened to Jimmy Carter. It has been shameful, the treatment that he's received. Look at the treatment that Jim Baker is getting. It's shameful as well. I mean, the forces that don't want to debate, and they include all the elements in the pro-Israel community, from the neoconservatives to the pro-Israel parts, or I'm using quotes pro-Israel, because I think today that AIPAC and groups like that are not pro-Israel anymore. They're pro-status quo, which is killing Israel and killing the Arab world, and the religious right. I think all of that combined turns its wrath and ridicule on those who want a debate, and the result is that they end up silencing the debate. Jimmy Carter is a decent man trying to do the right thing. Jim Baker is a very thoughtful political and policy person trying to help salvage America in the Middle East, and they are being dumped on in an effort to silence any effort to have a reasonable debate in how we salvage ourselves and salvage honor in the Middle East.
Well, I'm afraid we
therefore am not hopeful.
Right.
I think we're in for a long and very difficult situation here.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Jim Zogby.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master, just speaking then with Jim Zogby, who is the president of the Arab American Institute. He commissioned a poll on Arab attitudes to the United States. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Kuth, the assistant producer, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.